Make sure you've got your lead-lined pants on. This podcast is radioactive. Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's programme, we look at the dull grey metal, which both keeps the world in check and on the edge of war.
I have to tell you a secret. I don't know because I don't want to know. I have a good guess, but it's between a pineapple and a truck.
The Science Museum finally gets an exhibit on climate change.
I see Copenhagen as 192 nations sitting around a table agreeing who will get how much of that half trillion tons and when. And then the subplot is what they will use it for.
And it unveils a map of what the world would look like if average temperatures rose by 4 degrees Celsius.
What more can I say? This is disastrous if it happens. We've got to meet that 2-degree target. It won't be easy, but we've got to do it.
Plus, Justin Timberlake did it with Sexy. Now we're going to do it with The Sound of Music. What I'm trying to say is that we're going to bring the sound of music back.
The singer is no longer able to sing if they're damaged enough, and certainly there are people who can't speak because they have had damaged vocal cords. So the question is, could we make basically a synthetic vocal cord?
How to solve a problem like Julie Andrews. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. With us in the studio this week is Amir Axel. He's a former physicist with books about Fermat's Last Theorem and also works as a research fellow in the history of science at Boston University. His latest treatise is on uranium. In Uranium Wars, Amir looks at how the radioactive metal has shaped the 20th century. Welcome, Amir. Can you start by describing this metal to us? Your book opens with the story of how literally uranium is out of this world.
A supernova is an explosion of a star. A star that's about 1.4 times larger than the sun will explode and become a neutron star or a black hole. So when a star of that size explodes, heavier elements are made, those that are heavier than iron. One of the heaviest of all is uranium occurring naturally. So all the uranium in the world comes from the supernova explosions in nearby stars a long time ago. Everything on Earth comes from this a stellar dust that condenses and because of the mutual gravitational force comes together. And there are therefore traces of uranium everywhere, but deposits of uranium at various places on Earth. So it all originates, all the uranium originates in these exploding stars. Uranium is the heaviest element in the natural environment before people started making larger elements in terms of their weight, in terms of their mass. So because it's so heavy, it is radioactive. It's losing radiation. It's losing some of its mass in the form of energy. And people realized that in the first part of the 20th century and tried to do something which seems to me now very strange, which is to make a larger element. So you're trying to make... There are three teams in Berlin, Rome, and Paris trying to make uranium bigger by bombarding it with radiation.
Did people realize immediately that this could be turned into something which would, you know, power, which could make electricity or even do other things? Was the consequence sort of there in people's minds?
Well, there was one additional concept that had to be discovered before uranium could be viewed as a source of immense energy, either for nuclear bombs or for power generation. In a nuclear power plant. And that was the concept of a chain reaction. And the idea of a chain reaction was developed in January 1939 in a meeting among four scientists in New York at Columbia University. These were Niels Bohr, Enrico Fermi. Both of them came over from Europe. Fermi didn't want to go back to Europe because he was worried about fascism in his native Italy, Leo Szilard, who was a Hungarian-American scientist, and John Archibald Wheeler of Princeton. These four scientists, very bright scientists, among the brightest, meeting together at the cafeteria, the dining hall of Columbia University in New York, realized that if uranium, when it undergoes fission, which was understood in late 38, at Christmas 1938 to be exact, if that could be done in a chain reaction, meaning that one atom leads to another and so on. The fission goes from one to another in the sense that neutrons are released, causing the break of more and more nuclei. This could be a huge power source. So that's the realization was made in at the beginning of 1939.
And so within 6 years, we all know what happened. The bomb was dropped over Hiroshima, the nuclear bomb was dropped over Hiroshima, and that's a spectacularly fast sort of progress from realizing the chain reaction, realizing that fission was possible in the nucleus of the uranium atom, to essentially a world-destroying weapon. Take us through what happened.
Yes, this is a very interesting story, and one that I think has a lot to teach us, because it has to do with the relationship between pure science and world affairs and politics and decisions made by powerful people rather than scientists.
And so take us through what a nuclear bomb actually is. So how does this thing constructed? Where do you start? You start with, if you have uranium which you dig out of the ground, a process, you can't just use that uranium for a nuclear bomb.
No, not at all. The vast majority of the uranium in the world is not useful for a nuclear bomb. It is the uranium with weight 238. It's a heavier isotope. The lighter isotope, meaning it's chemically the same. They're both uranium, but one has less weight because it has three fewer neutrons. So its weight is slightly less, and that's the isotope number 235, with weight 235, that is used in a bomb. Now, the process is very, very complicated, because what you have to do is to separate the 235 from the 238. And 238 is a majority. It's 99.3% of the uranium in the world, or in the universe for all I know, is the heavier element, uranium-238, and only 0.7% is 235. So what happens is you have to find a way to separate the two, and what the Iranians are doing now, for example, is using centrifuges to spin it very fast, and then the lighter element stays in the center, and the heavier one moves, because of the centrifugal force, to the periphery of the apparatus. And so when you do this over many hours of this kind of work, you can produce a certain amount of uranium-235. Now, it's important to understand that uranium-235 is used for a bomb, and it has no other uses, really. So when the Iranians are saying we need this for power generation, for electricity, that's a lie, because you wouldn't. It's a very complicated process. It took the Americans, with aid from British scientists, 6 years, as you said, from 1939 to 1945. The bomb was ready on July 16, 1945, and was tested in the New Mexico desert. This was a plutonium bomb. That's another way of creating a bomb, by using uranium-238 inside the nuclear reactor. But the classic way of making is to produce uranium-235 and to keep it in two separate pieces that are subcritical. So once you put them together, there's too much weight there and it too much mass there, and it explodes.
Can you just explain this concept of the critical mass? So a lump of uranium-235, a small enough amount of it wouldn't go into a chain reaction, or it wouldn't explode just by itself. You do need a certain amount to actually create the bomb.
It has to do with the flux of neutrons. So when you have an atom, or a nucleus of an atom, that's the center of the atom, right, of uranium-235, when it is hit by a neutron, it will undergo this fission. It breaks down in two. Now, it so happens when this happens, other neutrons are released, and these neutrons hit other nuclei. Now, if you don't have too many of them, the reaction, which is continuous, as long as there's enough fissionable material there, is under control. It's slow, and it produces heat, but it doesn't go, it doesn't explode. But when you have a certain amount, and that's the big question, when you start working on a nuclear bomb, the big theoretical question is, what's the critical mass? How much do you need? That was a question that was facing the Americans in the Manhattan Project and the Nazis during the war. The Nazis for at one point thought that the amount needed to go critical is anywhere from the size, some of the Nazi scientists thought it was the size of a pineapple, and others thought it was the size of a car or a truck. So the key question is to solve this this puzzle to know exactly how much you need. Once you know, and you do that through experimentation, once you know how much you need, what is the critical mass, you have to separate two pieces that are subcritical, and yet when they come together, they go above critical, and that's how the bomb works.
How much is the critical mass?
I have to tell you a secret. I don't know because I don't want to know.
Just in case.
I have a good guess, but it's between a pineapple and a truck.
I would say there's some range there. Okay, Amir, we'll leave it there. Before we reveal any more bomb-making secrets, we're going to come back to Amir at the end of the program, of course, to talk a bit more about nuclear power and rogue nations. Uranium Wars, the scientific rivalry that caused a nuclear age, is out now. Hello all. Quick interlude following on from last week's iPhone iTouch experiment. Tapping the screen when you have this podcast showing should give you all the details about this program. Apparently it was a success and, it sort of worked. But if you found it didn't work for you, we think it's because you downloaded it over Wi-Fi rather than through your computer. Why this happens, I've got no idea. I don't even have an iPod or an iPhone. In a further development this week, you should find that the timings of the various segments of the program are also available. This was a cracking suggestion by a listener, thanks to Justin Waddle. Let us know what you think. Send us any feedback to the email address at the bottom of the text, and get involved with us on Twitter. Just search for Science Weekly or get all the Guardian Science content sent to you. Follow Guardian Science.
Science Weekly.
We'll have a look now at some of the other science stories around this week.
News Jack. US paleontologists are dismissing initial claims about Ida, the 47-million-year-old fossil who had been linked to humans. If you remember, her arrival was announced with unrestrained razzmatazz. She was the eighth wonder of the world, our Mona Lisa, and an evolutionary Rosetta Stone. The exquisitely preserved fossil was touted as the remains of our earliest human ancestor, the link between us and the rest of the animal kingdom. But now, a team of paleontologists from New York claim Ida is not related to humans at all. Instead, they conclude the $1 million fossil looks more like a small lemur or maybe a loris.
The next Stephen Hawking is a pioneer of string theory. Michael Green now holds the most prestigious academic post in the world. The Cambridge physicist, a fellow of the Royal Society and co-founder of the fiendishly complex idea of string theory, has been given the position of Lucasian Professor of Mathematics. Hawking stepped down from the position at the beginning of the month in accordance with Cambridge rules, stipulating the post must be vacated when the incumbent reaches their 67th birthday. He'd been in that role for 30 years.
NASA has unveiled its new rocket despite doubts over future funding. The US space agency rolled out a demonstration version of Ares 1X, even though proposals have been put to the White House to scrap the launcher. It's been moved to its launch pad and is due to take off Tuesday this week.
And happy 40th birthday to the internet. In October 1969, a student at the University of California typed LO on a computer, and the rest, as the cliche goes, is history. They were actually trying to type in login, but it crashed.
So, to discuss those stories, we've got a critical mass of Guardian Science journalists in the studio this week. David Adam, James Randerson, and Ian Sample. First off, Ida. Now, did we get this wrong? Was the world conned?
There was a paper published in Nature last week, which was by a team at Stony Brook University in New York, some paleontologists there, and they've done an analysis which suggests that Ida was not actually on the an evolutionary lineage that led to humans, apes, monkeys, but on another line that actually trundled off towards lemurs and lorises. So rather than being a sort of the much sort of publicized link between humans and sort of the rest of the animal kingdom, it's more a dead end. It's sort of a creature on a different lineage, which didn't actually go anywhere. It isn't known to have any living descendants.
James, the scientist who wrote the initial paper about Ida was Jørn Hurum at the Oslo University, the Natural History Museum there. In the paper, I think we were careful to say in the last podcast that in the paper, Jørn Hurum didn't actually talk about what line, whether Ida was on the anthropoid line or not. So is the new research really doing anything to sort of discredit what his interpretations were?
Well, my sort of interpretation of this is, rather unsurprisingly, this is kind of the opening salvo in what will probably be a 20-year, very acrimonious, bitchy discussion over whether Ida really is on the human line or not. And, you know, it'll be like Homo floresiensis all over again. You know, there'll just be paper and counterpaper and paper and counterpaper. And, you know, it will be, you know, fascinating academic debate, but it's hardly surprising, really.
So we should really be waiting for Jeroen Hurum's response to this in a peer-reviewed journal before we make any more sort of decisions about whether this really is the missing link or whatever or not.
Well, I mean, you know, from a sort of media reporting point of view, it would be kind of foolish to, every time there's a paper one way or the other, saying, oh no, it was all wrong, or oh, actually no, it's all right, you know, because
you're suggesting that we can't go backwards and forwards in our opinion of things. <What's>...
Never. I would like to say coffee definitely does cause cancer. No, it's one of those. It's one of the, I mean, there is something peculiar actually about paleontology, and particularly anything to do with human ancestry within paleontology. It becomes, I'm not really sure why. I think it's because there's so little to work with that your interpretation of it becomes so, you know, so personal and so tied to your own reputation. So when someone comes along and challenges that interpretation, it can turn into a very heated academic spat very quickly.
I think it's worth saying as well, there's more to this than science, isn't there? Because it was the way the science was presented at the time that was criticised. And that implicitly is what's being responded to now. I mean, Fossil Not Very Interesting is not a paper that gets published in Nature very often.
Ian, you quoted Jeroen Hurum as saying that it's interesting that it's taken 5 months for the first attack to come. So he was expecting this.
Yeah, I was going to say your point about, you know, needing to wait for Jeroen Hurum's response in a peer-reviewed journal. I don't think we do. I mean, I just asked, I got him on his mobile in between lectures, and I said, "Well, what do you make of this? These people saying your million-dollar fossil is part, you know, almost on the way to being a lemur rather than anything, you know, that we might see as more interesting from our perspective." It's interesting, in the paper, you're right, he didn't actually talk about whether this was on the anthropoid line or on the line that led to lemurs and lorises and such like. But they really do think that. I mean, you know, he says we stand by our analysis and that's where they think it sits. Ditto Philip Gingrich at Princeton, who got in touch and said that they absolutely think that it is along those lines.
He's no slouch, is he? I mean, you know.
Not remotely, no.
He's saying
there are enormous
not.
Reputations at stake here, and they think that it is quite remarkable that Eric Seifer, is the guy at Stony Brook, is saying that a lot of these features in Darwinius and the new fossil that was found co-evolved rather than were actually on this lineage. They think that's quite an odd thing to presume from the data they've got.
For everything you want to know about these stories, go to guardian.co.uk/environment/science.
The hills are alive with the sound of music, with songs they have sung for 1,000 years.
Now this one's for all you Sound of Music fans out there. If in a dark moment you've ever wanted to hear Julie Andrews sing again, your luck might be in. Because she might be the recipient of the latest in synthetic vocal cords. Hers were damaged when she underwent surgery to remove a non-cancerous nodule, meaning that she couldn't hold a note and lost her 5-octave vocal range. But the hope for new vocal cords comes from research by MIT's Robert Langer, an expert in tissue regeneration. The Guardian's Ian Sample caught up with him last week to find out more.
A number of years ago, Steven Zeitels, he's a very outstanding clinician, and he treats people who have vocal cord damage. One of them, people he's treated, is Julie Andrews. And he came to see me because we've done a lot of work, in fact, started a lot of the field of what we now call regenerative medicine or tissue engineering. And the way we approached it was to try to create materials, polymers, and in some cases combine them with cells that could create a new tissue or organ. This is already leading to new skin and hopefully will lead to other tissues and organs as well. There are a number in clinical trials. So Steve and Rox Anderson, who worked with them, and Bob Hillman came to see me and they said, well, could we come up with new materials that might behave like a vocal cord for people who have damaged vocal cords. And by the way, I should add, people who are, they could be singers who have enormous stress on their vocal cords. They could be people who've been doing a lot of public speaking. There could be people almost at any age who have had what's called intubation, tubes put in their throats when they were very young and can't speak at all, hardly. They could be people who have had cancer and various things. So the question is, could we make basically a synthetic vocal cord? So working with first Mariah Hahn, who was one of my graduate students, now professor at Texas, we tried to characterize the properties of the vocal cords. And then Cindy Zhao and much more recently Sandeep, who's both very, very good polymer chemists who work in my laboratory, we've tried to create new materials, in some cases based on polyethylene glycol, that would be very compatible but gel-like and have very similar, what I should call biomimetic properties to a vocal cord. And so right now we've actually synthesized such materials. They have been tested in animals. The initial results are going quite well in terms of safety and efficacy, and our hope is that in the next couple of years there'll be a clinical trial starting so we can see how well this might work on human beings.
And what is the outcome for these patients at the moment? I mean, what are their options as the sort of state of technology sits at the moment?
Well, I think certainly if somebody's a singer, I think it's difficult. I mean, there might be surgical procedures that Dr. Zeitels or others could do, but I think, really damaged vocal cords, I mean, it's the singer is no longer able to sing if they're damaged enough, and certainly there are people who can't speak because they have had damaged vocal cords from intubation or other things.
When I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite things, and then I don't feel so bad.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
This week, the Science Museum in London finally got an exhibit on climate change. They said the move was as significant as the Natural History Museum, next door, supporting the theory of evolution by natural selection. The museum hopes its new exhibit will provide all the in-depth scientific evidence members of the public might want to convince them that climate change is happening. Producer Andy went for the tour.
I'm Professor Chris Rapley. I'm Director of the Science Museum and Professor of Climate Science at University College London. The Science Museum believes that climate change, current climate change, is real, driven by humans, and potentially very threatening. It can threaten our food supplies, our water supplies, it can threaten our health, and it can threaten world security. So humanity needs to take some action, because the reason that climate change is happening is that by burning fossil fuels, we're releasing carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and that's changing the heat balance of the planet. I see Copenhagen as follows. Sometime in the last year, humanity burnt the half trillionth ton of coal, oil or gas. We don't know what it was, but it passed unnoticed. And the most optimistic estimates say that we can probably burn about another half trillion tons before we've got to stop, because as we burn coal, oil or gas, the carbon dioxide sits up in the atmosphere. So I see Copenhagen as 192 nations sitting around a table agreeing who will get how much of that half trillion tons and when, and then the subplot is what they will use it for. We need to use it for three things: to improve equity around the world, to achieve the millennium goals, if you like, because 2 billion people, you know, go to bed hungry each day, to keep the wheels on Western society because we're completely dependent on the flow of hydrocarbon fuels, and then to invest in the future by developing an energy system that is not so carbon intensive. And we really have to get our carbon emissions down dramatically by 2050, which may seem a long way away, but if we keep burning carbon at the rate we're doing, we'll burn that other half trillion tons by as early as 2045.
Do you think the skeptics are gaining ground at the moment?
Well, look, I'm a scientist, I'm a professional skeptic, so I'd prefer to call them something else. They're contrarians, and there are two groups of people. There are people who just simply don't believe it but aren't necessarily experts, and then there's a sort of dedicated group of people who are actively promoting the idea that this is not an issue. I'm a scientist, I'm a physicist. You know, I've been working one way or another on Earth system science and the use of satellites to study the planet since the early 1980s. I've watched this story develop, I've looked at the evidence. My assessment is that although obviously the climate goes all over the place for all sorts of reasons, just at present, over the last 20 or 30 years, humanity has emerged as a major driver of climate change. Now, the reason I'm worried about that is I've got children and grandchildren. It turns out that the climate has been relatively stable for the last 10,000 years since we came out of the last ice age. That's allowed humanity to develop civilization, agriculture, find more or less enough food for 6.5 billion people and so on. And provoking the climate system into a new mode, I think, is very dangerous.
Director of the Science Museum, Chris Rapley there. Now, also at this event, the museum unveiled a new map detailing what the world might look like if temperatures rose by an average of 4 degrees Celsius. It's been developed with the Met Office ahead of the Copenhagen summit to show what would happen if the world fails to cut carbon emissions. The government wheeled out its big hitters to launch the map, including a rare double appearance by the Miliband brothers, Ed and David, the Climate Change Secretary and Foreign Secretary respectively. Also on hand were two of Britain's leading voices on science and climate change.
I'm John Beddington, I'm the Government Chief Scientific Advisor. It's very pleasing that the global community has taken 2 degrees as its target for the Copenhagen negotiations, and it's enormously important that is successful. Doesn't mean to say there's no problems with climate change if the 2 degree target is met. There are problems and we've got to address them. But if we fail in Copenhagen and we get a 4 degree rise in temperature sometime this century, the sort of disastrous things that are going to happen. Enormous problems of water shortage, enormous problems of sea level rises generating international migration, enormous problems of food shortages in a population that is growing. We already know we have to generate something like 50% more food by 2050. So a 4 degree target doesn't mean everywhere is 4 degrees. 4 degrees means that in some places it could be as high as 12 or indeed 16 degrees in the Arctic, which has consequences, for example, of further melting of the Arctic ice, increases in sea level, and enormous problems of that. Indeed, if you think of a little further south of the Arctic, you think about the tundra, the sort of changes you'll see then is temperatures will mean that the tundra will melt, that vegetation locked up in the frozen tundra will decompose, producing methane, which will go into the upper atmosphere again and further feed the climate change. So we have got to avoid this at all costs.
I'm Vicky Pope, I'm Head of Climate Change Advice at the Met Office Hadley Centre. Well, the map was produced by using a whole series of model projections and looking at when those projections reached 4 degrees and then averaging them out. So it averages out some of the differences that you get in regional changes. But what it shows very clearly is that there's, at 4 degrees global warming, there's quite a bit more warming over land than over the sea. So over the land we've got 5.5 degrees. And the reason for that difference is because the ocean takes a long time to warm up because the heat basically goes into the deep ocean, whereas the land, it just warms the surface, and so you're basically warming the air. Also, if you look at high latitudes, you can see that it's much warmer than it is at low latitudes, so we're getting warmings of up to 16 degrees in the Arctic, for example. And one of the reasons for that is that ice reflects a lot of sunlight, so as the ice starts to melt as the temperatures go up, more sunlight reaches the surface and you get more warming, and so you get what we call a positive feedback, but it's better to call it really an enhanced feedback because there's nothing positive about it in terms of the outcome.
What are some of the most worrying aspects of this map?
Well, I think those very large increases in temperatures in some regions are very worrying. Big increases in heat waves, so it's actually the extremes of weather that actually will hit us most rather than the average changes. So things like the summer of 2003 when we had a heat wave, the summer of 2006, and those sorts of things will become much more common in the future. In the UK, for example, we'll see that kind of thing by 2040, it'll be every other year. By 2060, we could be having summers like that, could be unusually cool. So just for the UK, we'd see that. You know, in many parts of the world, we'll also see big increases in heat waves. Increases in drought and flooding. As temperature goes up globally, the average amount of rainfall will go up. There'll be more water in the atmosphere. Basically, water evaporates from the ocean and the land surface when the temperature's higher. And so you get a more active water cycle, as we call it, which means where it's raining, it rains harder, and where it's not raining, it rains less. And so you get this drought, this pattern of drought and flooding. So those are some of the main impacts. And of course that will then have impacts on things like crop productivity as well and water availability for people.
You can see the map on our website, environmentguardian.co.uk. With us now is our environment correspondent, David Adam. David, you were at the event. What were the Miliband's doing there?
I mean, Ed Miliband is the Energy and Climate Change Secretary, and David is Foreign Secretary and was former Environment Secretary, but he's still very clued into the green world. So, and I think there's a security implication for climate change, and the Foreign Office are one of the big departments pushing on this.
And one of the things that they were really talking about was this map that we published in the centre pages of the paper last week, which shows what the world might look like if there's a 4-degree average temperature rise. Now, we've heard about 2-degree average temperature rises, and that would be catastrophic. Why are they talking about 4 all of a sudden?
Well, it's something that the scientists have been talking about for a while, but the politicians have been reluctant to, for pretty obvious reasons. And I think there are two reasons. One is that I think there are some pretty good people now in the British government behind the scenes, and they're trying to close this sort of reality gap between what the scientists are talking about and the politicians are talking about. You know, it's just not realistic for the politicians to be talking about 2 degrees, 2 degrees, 2 degrees, while you have scientific papers coming out looking at what might happen if you get 4, 5, even more. And I think also this is of course in the run up to this much talked about Copenhagen negotiations in December. And I think this is the British government's latest attempt to get those negotiations moving. And effectively, it's a scare tactic. It's like, look what will happen if we don't get a deal.
Is that likely that the world's going to go to 4? What do the scientists say?
Well, the Met Office did a study recently, which was sort of a retweaking of other work. But broadly, it said that if emissions continue at the current rate, so if we don't get any kind of deal to bring them down, then we're looking at 4 degrees by between 2070 and 2100, and maybe even as soon as 2060. It depends on things like the carbon feedbacks.
So take us through the map a little bit. I mean, 4 degrees doesn't sound terrible as an average temperature rise. So what are the details?
Well, this is what's really striking about the map, actually. It's worth people digging it out. Because a 4-degree average rise is just that, an average. And most of the world is oceans, which don't warm up very quickly, certainly not as quickly as the land. So 4-degree rise over the world is a great deal greater than that in some places over the land. For example, you're looking at 6 degrees in Florida and the southeast United States. You're looking at 7 degrees in New York, and that's an average rise. So you're going to get some days where it's 8, 9, 10 degrees higher. I mean, Britain actually, sort of paradoxically, doesn't do. It comes out actually less than 4 degrees because we're surrounded by water and so on and so on. But there are some places where a 4-degree rise average means 16 degrees.
Where's
you
that?
Know, up in the Arctic. And if you talk to people about a 16-degree increase, it just sounds like you're moving to a different planet.
That's the end of all of the ice up there, definitely.
You would have thought so. Yeah.
To remind you, that interactive map is available at environmentguardian.co.uk. So that's the science. And there was plenty of politics discussed with this as well. As a special treat, you'll find the whole of that media launch as a podcast on the Science Weekly feed, which includes this.
This would be a high-pressure world. High pressure on migration, high pressure from conflict. The decisions of a UK government in respect to those issues are obviously something for long in the future. But given the scope of our global interests and our global commitments, that high pressure on the UK can only lead to cost for the UK.
There's also a video from the event. Click on the link in the blog.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Back to this week's studio guest, Amir Axel, whose new book, Uranium Wars, looks at how an innocuous-looking metal turned the fate of the 20th century. Amir, we know how the atom bomb changed the course of the Second World War, but let's bring things right up to date. One of the legacies of that time is nuclear power stations. They're increasingly attractive now, especially given that we're worried about carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants and things. Are you positive about nuclear power?
That's a good question and a very big one. I naturally am worried about radiation and radioactive waste and Well, I lived through Chernobyl. I'm old enough for that. And I remember the fear in the world here in Europe and also in the United States, all over the world. You know, the radiation was floating around the atmosphere for weeks. So the problem with nuclear power is once you make a mistake, as these Ukrainian nuclear power station workers did, they just shut off the emergency system at 3 o'clock in the morning and started playing around. Of course, the alarm was off and it went critical and exploded. They had no containment building, and we still suffer from it because I think that there are people every day who get cancer because of Chernobyl. Having said that, we're facing other problems that are either equally large or even greater, and the biggest of which is probably global warming. Global warming is causing, we see it every day. I mean, think of a place like Venice. The rising seas eventually will cover it. It's affecting agriculture. It's affecting our energy. We need energy and air conditioning and things like that. So I think global warming is a huge problem. But remember, there are other ways of solving it. The energy can come from solar power, wind power, and slightly more problematic, and maybe a lot more problematic, hydropower, because you have to build dams. Again, though, nuclear power is important, and it does provide an important component of the mix of energy. In addition to global warming, there's also the cost of fossil fuels, which keeps rising all the time, especially now we're coming out of a recession, global recession, and yet as soon as the economy starts moving again, consumption goes up of oil products, and therefore the prices go up. So there's also the economic concern that when you produce these fuels based on, not only are you increasing the carbon emissions, but you're also increasing the cost and other forms of pollution. So we have to consider nuclear as a good alternative. But we must solve other problems related to it, such as nuclear waste and safety from terrorism and things like that.
But the other side of the coin, of course, is that you potentially proliferate the weapons as well. I mean, is that something really to be concerned about? We touched on Iran, but is that something that we should be concerned about?
That's a huge concern. It's unbelievably huge. During the Second World War, there was this doctrine called the MAD doctrine, M-A-D, which is mutually assured destructions. There was us on one hand here, the West, and then there was the Soviet bloc. But as we know today, the Soviets didn't want to commit suicide either. And that's what prevented us from being destroyed during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 and the Vietnam War and all these global Korean War. This global conflict had developed at various times and always ended because both the Soviet Union and the West understood that if you start these bombs, the planet won't survive. But you don't have that with rogue nations. You have, and not to mention terror organizations. If you're going to kill people in a subway or an airplane and die with them, then the fact that you might die doesn't scare you. So that MAD, the mutually assured destruction, doesn't work. So that's what worries me. I'm very seriously worried about Iran, North Korea, and even Pakistan, which has many nuclear weapons, and they're not perhaps as safe as they could be, with the Taliban being nearby and the regime there not being as stable as it might be.
Okay, well, on that thoroughly depressing note, we'll leave it there. My thanks to Amir for coming in. His book, Uranium Wars, is out now. Thanks too to The Guardian's Ian Sample, James Randerson, and David Adam. Next week, Professor David Delpy with us. He's the Chief Executive of the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council. That's the main government agency for funding research and training in engineering and physical sciences. We'd love to get your thoughts and questions for him. Just post them at the usual places, please. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.